Oh, wow. It's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
Hello, Ellen.
Hi, Lillian, and real commiserations about your pop. Sounds like he was a real hard case.
He was such a hard case.
just like his granddaughter, I think. So, yeah.
Thanks, Ellen. I appreciate that. Sorry to drop that on you without telling. It was sort of all last-minute news this morning, but we are doing good, and I'm sure he's listening in some way. Anyway, how are we going? We're talking moisture.
We are. We're talking art, for goodness sake, today on Dear Science, and specifically a painting that probably everybody knows when they see it, even if they don't necessarily know the name of it.
Right.
But Edvard Munch's The Scream.
Of course, you know of course.
One? Yeah, indeed. I did some research on this, and I was amazed to find that he actually painted four versions of this. There were two in paint and two in pastel. And one of them sold for a ridiculous $119 million, I think, a few years ago. Just absolute,
wow.
Absolute nuts. Absolute nuts. Anyway, it is one of the more famous paintings, certainly of the 20th century anyway. The one that we're going to talk about was painted in 1910. He did the original in 1893, and then for some reason he redid it in 1910. And this lives in the Munch Museum in Oslo. And they keep it under very, very stringent conditions in the Munch Museum in Oslo because it's starting to fade. Which is not good. Yeah, exactly. And particularly, it's the yellows. It's the yellow paint that Munch used. It is fading, and it's also starting to flake off as well, which is not really
not
good.
Not ideal at all.
Not ideal. So there are a bunch of very, very lucky workers from basically right around the world, from Europe, USA, and Brazil. And they very, very fortunately were given access to this particular painting. Now, this one was actually stolen in 2004 and got returned in 2006.
Oh.
But they got real access to it. So they could take micro flecks of the paint off to have a look at what's happening. And they could also take the whole painting itself and subject it to the very, very, very latest in analytical techniques. So this is absolutely high-end stuff.
Yeah, that's major.
I know, it's absolutely brilliant. You know, they're very, very lucky to get this sort of access. And basically what they were looking at, you know, again, they were trying to figure out what's the best way to store this painting so that it doesn't keep fading. So in other words, the question is, why is it fading?
Mm-hmm.
And so the what's going on is a pigment called cadmium sulfide, okay? And that's got the chemical formula CDS, nice and easy. And
of course.
It's a beautiful yellow, bright, 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 bright yellow color. But as I say, it is busy fading. These yellow bits are fading. And what is happening is that it's turning from yellow cadmium sulfide with a D,
yes,
to white cadmium sulfate.
Oh dear.
And yeah, it's not good. And so the question is, why is it doing that? And what people have thought up until now is that when it comes to keeping old paintings and stuff like that, you need to make sure that the light source or the light, the ambient light conditions, you know, are very, very, very carefully regulated, because it's been thought that that's what causes fading of paintings primarily, is light, and probably specifically ultraviolet light.
Mm-hmm.
However, what these folk have found is that light is not the problem with this one. And with The Scream, what is happening is that it is the moisture in the air that's the important thing. And the yellow cadmium sulfide is being turned into white cadmium sulfate through a process called oxidation.
Yes.
And that is the problem. It seems that the oxidation is speeded up by moisture. Okay. And up until now, they've been keeping the painting at a relative humidity of around about 50%.
That's terrible.
Well, it might be. It might be that this is the case. You know, this is what's going on. The fact that you've got this moisture in the air. You've also got the presence of chloride in the paint as well. And again, that seems to be a factor that aids the oxidation as well. So it's the actual the paint that Munch used. And in fact, they did have a tube of the paint that he did actually use. I don't know how the hell they came by that, They had that, and they could subject that to accelerated aging. They could find out what that was doing over time, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All these extraordinarily fancy, really expensive techniques. And that seems to be what the situation is now, that maybe when people are storing their paintings, then they're going to have to look more at the presence of moisture in the air. And they may have to, you know, maybe store things under conditions of lower moisture. That's the answer, I guess, that these guys have come up with this particular painting. So
that's not going to be ideal for most New Zealand homes, which are fairly damp.
yeah, but most New Zealand homes don't have a Munch floating on the wall, really.
This is fair. Okay.
not at $119 million a pop.
Right. Anyways. True. Yeah. Okay. Wow. I guess this would be science that may be then taken into art galleries and that sort of thing, though, for consideration.
Oh, very much so. Yeah, absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. You know, this is really, really nice science. And, you know, I don't know how they got into this, but I think it'd be a fabulous thing to get into. I think it'd be absolutely fascinating going around all the old art galleries and everything, looking at the old paintings and seeing if you can stop their inevitable decay. So,
yeah.
Nice stuff.
Yeah. Nice. Okay. Now, talking about the North Magnetic Pole, which you knew, I guess, that it moved, but you didn't know that it moved so much.
Yeah. Indeed. If you look on a map, you know, remember they used to have these the paper things called maps, remember, before?
Yeah, I think phones? So. I think you so.
And there was always something up in the top right-hand corner of the map, and it said that you have to apply this correction for the movement of the magnetic pole and blah, 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 and it's so many, you know, degrees per year or whatever. And, you know, it's kind of important to know where your north magnetic pole is because of that particular reason. You know, every sort of thing that is to do with navigation or whatever pretty much involves knowing the position of the north magnetic pole. Now, the one thing that we do know is that it is moving and that it always has moved.
Yes.
And it was discovered way back in about the 1830s or so. And at that stage, it was in northern Canada. And now, as of 2017, it's actually crossed the international date line, and now it's heading for Siberia.
Wow.
Which I think is kind of cool. And the fact that it's moving roughly 50 or 60 kilometres a year.
That's
major. Which to me is pretty darn quick, okay? And it's certainly speeded up over the last, oh, gosh, probably, you know, 2, 3, 4 decades or so.
How does, what? Okay, this is surely going to, like, throw a lot of things out of whack.
Well, it's not so much throw, well, it will do if corrections aren't made for it, okay? And so, obviously, the people who worry about such things are busily, you know, doing all of these corrections and everything. So we're all okay in that respect. But, what people are thinking is, you know, why is it moving so fast? What's going on? And so there's a bunch of scientists at Leeds University, and they've just published a paper on this. And what they think is that there are two big old magnetic blobs on the edge of the Earth's outer core, okay, so inside the Earth there. And one of them is basically centered in northern Canada, and the other one is sort of centered in Siberia. And what they seem to think, and it's all a little bit hand-wavy, I guess, but they seem to think that there's this big sort of movement of molten material in the interior of the Earth. And what that does is that it either favors the sort of the Canada side, or it favors the Siberia side, okay, at the expense of the other one. And seemingly what they think is happening now is that this flow of the molten material, which is probably sort of molten iron and stuff like that, and iron and nickel, they seem to be sort of what goes on in the middle of the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And they seem to think that, yeah, what's happening is a general movement of this molten material in such a way that now you're favoring that magnetic blob that is under Siberia rather than that magnetic blob that's under Canada. So,
wow. That's fuzzy.
It's pretty amazing, but I guess it goes to show that really We can send sort of spacecrafts to, you know, beyond the solar system, but we really don't really know what the hell's in the middle of our own planet. You know, we've only just drilled, literally, we've only just scratched the surface. You know, that's an apt metaphor, I think. You know?
But it's also, it's a bit alarming that we're so desperate to kind of figure out what's going on out there when we don't know what's happening under our own feet.
Well, I think the geologists would say give us more money, I think.
Okay, fair call. All right, well, let's finish then on liquid and how runny it actually is, an odd question.
Now, when was the last time that anybody actually asked that question? How runny can a liquid be?
I don't recall ever asking it.
No, indeed. And that just sort of, you know, took my fancy, I think, that when I was looking around for stories for this. And this is all to do with viscosity. And so viscosity is how we measure, for want of a better word, runniness. Okay, so if something is very, very viscous, then it's very, very thick and it doesn't run very well. And obviously the opposite, if you've got a very, very, very low viscosity, then you run just, you know, absolutely brilliantly. You're very, very runny. Now, what we know, and this sort of stands to reason, hopefully, is that when you heat up a liquid, it gets runnier. So you start with a thick liquid, you heat it up, it gets runnier, it gets less and less viscous. And if you keep heating it up, it's going to get less and less and less viscous until the point where your liquid turns into a gas. Okay?
Yeah.
And in that case, it's no longer a liquid anymore. So people have been trying to model viscosity. It's one of the things in science. You try and put numbers to things. You try and predict how things are going to act, just basically from first principles and using numbers and stuff and using equations, et cetera, et cetera. And it's really difficult to do this for viscosity because viscosity depends very, very strongly on the structure or not of the actual liquid that you're looking at. And people don't really, we don't really understand the structures of liquids yet. And
okay.
So it's a very, very difficult thing to do mathematically. However, these guys in England and Russia, again, just last week or so, have published a paper saying that they've figured out what the minimum possible viscosity of any liquid is. And that's quite remarkable simply because of all of that stuff I was saying before, how difficult this is to do using maths, using equations, et cetera, et cetera. But it turns out that there's a very, very simple equation that can be derived that shows the minimum possible viscosity of any liquid. It doesn't matter what liquid it is. And what it depends on are two fundamental constants of nature, the Planck's constant and a thing called the mass of the electron to proton ratio, or the proton electron mass ratio, which won't mean much to probably many listeners.
Yeah, I'm just gonna say I'm following. I think
I'm losing you here. I can, but that's the really, really interesting thing, is that it comes down to this really, really simple equation, but that it also depends on fundamental constants of nature, and nobody had thought that that was going to be the case, sort of up until now. So
yeah.
Kind of a bit of an arcane story to finish on, but really quite interesting if you are at all sort of interested in that kind of thing.
Yeah,
in trying to model things.
Right.
And explain nature using maths.
And numbers.
Which is kind of cool.
Cool. Very cool. I guess a quick fire round, maybe. Hand sanitizer, that's obviously liquid.
It is.
Would that be more or less runny than, I don't know, water?
Well, it all depends on your temperature and stuff like that. But right. At a quick guess, I would say it's more runny.
Okay.
So, you know, something that, like a classic example of viscosity is always tomato sauce, you know.
That's
pretty viscous. Or golden syrup or something like that.
Right.
Really thick and viscous and stuff. But we can now, thanks to the wonders of science, know what the minimum possible viscosity of tomato sauce
phew.
So there you go.
I'm glad we figured that out.
Well spent taxpayers' money.
All right. Hey, thanks so much, Alan, and we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks, maybe, hopefully, in person.
Wow, that'd be cool.
Exciting.
Take it easy.
Talk soon. Bye.
Okay, see ya.
Mind blowing. That was Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.